The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating 50 years of promoting greater awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. On June 12, 2008, Joe Fuller, co-founder and CEO of Monitor Group, a leading international consulting firm, spoke to the Korea Society about issues of global governance and strategy that will impact the future development of Korean international competitiveness.
Well, good afternoon, and thank you for taking time out of what I'm sure are busy days to join us today at the Korea Society. As Frederick said, this is Korea is a country that I've known in some way since I was really quite a young person, and we had the great privilege as a Monitor Group to be the first consulting firm of international stature to actually register with the authorities. They had to come up with a new designation for us. They wanted to know if we were a law firm or an accounting firm at first, and we tried to explain we were not that. This is in 1990. They had to come up with a new title for us. So we have a long history in the Korean market, which I'm pleased to say over time has become a much more sophisticated consumer of services such as ours, causes us to, in worldwide, our best market share in any market happens to be in Korea. So maybe that shows good room for improvement for us elsewhere, but we're also very proud of that fact because we think it's a very discerning market now. I'm delighted to talk about this topic of the evolution of large companies in Korea and how improvements in both the model of governance and also in their global strategies can help build on the tremendous record of success of Korean companies in the global marketplace. But before I do that, I think it's a particularly important time in the relationship of Korea with the world and of Korean companies with the world. And in fact, given what I think are some real prospects for some instability in Asia in the next several years, an important time for old friends like the United States and Korea to keep their focus on long-term shared objectives and not get overly focused with the political issues of the day. We are plagued in a situation now where you have a reasonably significant amount of tension in China. We have what amounts to political paralysis in Japan, which may be redundant since Japan has been politically paralyzed for several years. Obviously, we have continued issues with North Korea. But that's in the context of a world economic situation, which is quite unsettled, obviously, both with inflation and commodity prices, weakness of the dollar. But kind of importantly, I think, for Korean companies, the growing influence, the sudden rise of some major countries with their own corporate enterprises that are rather well-to-do right now, have quite a lot of resources to invest, but are also rather unsophisticated players on the world scene. So we have, and I point to companies like those headquartered in China and Brazil, who are beginning, and arguably some in the Middle East, mostly in the form of sovereign wealth funds, that are beginning to try to express their economic interest internationally and doing it in a way that is in some ways not welcome by the markets in which they're investing. And that is very, very important for an export-oriented country like Korea that relies on world trade and relies on the acceptability of foreign multinationals in other countries to prosper. So I think there are some secular trends right now that have to be of general concern to Korea. And of course, within that, there are all the recent political difficulties in Korea. We're not here to talk about politics. I'm just an interested observer of Korean politics, nothing like an expert. But I do think that there are two truths at work right now that are going to shape the context for Korean companies. The first is, obviously, we have a situation where the current government is I would say enjoying poor popularity, but I don't think you enjoy poor popularity, is unpopular, and where their path forward is a little cloudy, despite potential concessions by the president that have been discussed in the newspapers. I do think, though, that has to be viewed in the context of generally the way not only Koreans feel about their government in the world, but the way the world feels about their government. If you look at the popularity ratings of the Prime Minister of Great Britain, the President of France, the President of the United States, the Prime Minister of Canada, they're all at record lows. And so there's a general dissatisfaction with elected heads of state in much of the world right now, and Korea is certainly no exception to that. It's also, just out of interest in preparing for today, I took a quick look at the popularity ratings as I could find them for Kim Il-sung, Kim Dae-jung, President No, and President Lee, and it's a stair step. Kim Il-sung at this point had an 80% approval rating. Kim Dae-jung had a 60% approval rating at this point. President No had a 40% approval rating at this point, and now we have a record low with President Lee at 20%. This presumably means the next president will have a 0% approval rating if we follow the law of the tyranny of mathematics. But if we put aside the political issues, the so-called, you know, Ko-so-young mentality of President Lee. I hope I don't offend anybody with a few asides on politics. There are many truths about his policies and his policy position as embedded in the so-called 747 plan that have a lot of merit to them. And they're particularly important for Korean companies and their continued competitiveness. In fact, just saying that an objective of the government is to enhance Korea's competitiveness relative to that of Japan and that of China is an important statement, because there are reasons to be concerned that the historical competitive model of Korea is not going to be a durable one going forward. And integral to that, of course, integral to this notion of restarting the engine of advancement is a phrase that I've heard the president use, and creating a nation that's full of new opportunities is essentially requires two things. The first is that there be continued growth of free trade in the world. Korea is an export economy, and importantly, it's an export economy of manufactured goods, which are the most vulnerable goods to trade wars, to tariffs, to barriers visible and invisible. So even though there are many tensions about the CAFTA and the CAFTA negotiations and many arguments about that are very passionately felt, Korea must be on the side of free trade to prosper. And a success of CAFTA is going to give you Korea a lover with the Australians, with the New Zealanders, with the Malaysians, with the Europeans, who hate it when the United States have a free trade agreement and they don't, so you get one with them very quickly. Driving that to some type of politically acceptable closure, I think, is a legitimate policy objective for the government, and I hope something that can be achieved. We just have to remember that companies, Samsung Electronics, 87% of their revenue is from exports, 84% of LG Electronics, almost 75% of Hyundai Motors is export business. So it may not be politically palatable. It may not be. Something that it is something this government has done a very poor job in mobilizing Korean public opinion to accept. But it is an absolute priority that companies establish free trade. I've also, by the way, before I turn a little bit more to the subject at hand about companies and the changes I hope to see in terms of their governance and strategy going forward, is I've heard this phrase about, you know, the equality of the relationship and how the negotiation over CAFTA reflects continued inequality of the relationship. And I'm puzzled by that, because actually when one studies the history of free trade and trade agreements, you have an equal relationship when everybody's unhappy with the outcome and everyone's arguing about it. Unequal relationships in trade agreements are, here are the terms, you accept them. Free trade agreements between equal partners in negotiation are usually pretty good deals when none of the parties are all that happy with the outcome. Everyone's made concessions they don't like. And I think when you couple that with everything from the the so-called NATO plus three status in terms of arms shipments and arms sales that Korea received just recently, and what the ambassador, Ambassador Verbo, said about Korean control in the event of an armed conflict of the joint forces. Those are not the signs of an unequal relationship. Those are the signs of a maturing relationship where U.S. government bureaucracy is beginning to give Korea, I think, the credit she deserves as a more mature democracy and as an important partner for American interests going forward. Well, let me come more directly to the topic at hand about the evolution of governance in Korea and corporate strategy in Korea and what I think is going to be required to maintain Korea's dynamism and success in the world environment. And if there's one thing that can be said about the achievement of anything like the goals embedded in the so-called 747 campaign promises, I'm assuming everyone's familiar with that, 7% annual growth, $40,000 per capita GDP in the year 2018, and number 7 world economy, which is something President Lee has used on the campaign trail. Achieving that is going to be hugely dependent on the continued success of big Korean companies, not just Korean companies, but big Korean companies. Korea is overrepresented in the G500, the biggest 500 companies globally, with 16 members. It has 4 of the top 100, Samsung, LG, Hyundai, and SK, just creeping over the line recently in the number 98 position. 45% of GDP is represented by the revenue of 3 companies. So, yes, it's very important that a small and medium enterprise sector emerge and that they not just be effectively low-cost captive suppliers of the tribal, but if for Korea's continued success in the intermediate term, it will continue to be what military strategists call the battle of the big battalions. It's going to be big Korean companies being successful and extending their world presence. And to do that, I believe they're going to have to progress in 5 areas. And that's what I'd like to focus my comments upon. External governance, by which I mean the way companies are regulated, governed, disclosure, many things all of you are familiar about, and which are widely written about relative to Korea. Internal governance, the way the company is actually managed, companies' human asset policies, their investment in innovation, and the way they approach live globalization, the way they conceive of globalizing their companies. So those are the 5 areas I'd like to talk about. Let me start with external governance. Now, despite the fact that there's quite a bit of turmoil right now in the governance area in Korea, I think it's easy to lose track of how much progress has been made within the last 10 years. But there have been significant changes to the commercial code, the Security Exchange Act, Fair Trade Act. So we now do have proxies. We now do have better financial reporting. We now do have the beginnings of board independence. Although, you know, sometimes I say from a corporate perspective, Seoul is the smallest big town on the planet. Everyone knows everybody and everyone has an opinion about everyone else, sometimes more charitable than others. There have been restrictions on self-dealing. There have been enhancement of minority shareholder rights. So throughout the late 90s and the early part of this decade, a lot of progress was made on external governance, although I don't know if it's enough for activists like Professor Jang Ha-sung or others who are severe critics of the regime. Having said that, the progress is not enough in external governance. And that's visible in several ways. There are some recurring problems. And in cases are well known to you, things like SK Shipping, Hyundai Shipping. And some of those problems cause external financial sources, external regulators to think back to Hanbo, to think back to Daewoo, and get nervous that this is the next generation of problem or scandal that's being covered up. And as global economic volatility increases, those concerns increase with them. Moreover, even though IMD, the famous business school in Switzerland, actually the president is a former partner of mine at Mother, who does the World Economic Forum rankings in terms of competitiveness, place Korea 29 It's been losing ground, actually, a little bit. There have been Saudi Arabia, of all places, has just passed it, which I was stunned by. It shows you that all methodologies are subject to error because that can't possibly be true. But in fact, IMD would rank Korea as 51st in out of 60 countries they rank in terms of the robustness of accounting standards. And a 7th out of 12 leading Asian economies in terms of the soundness of governance practice, in front of such economic powerhouses as the Philippines. So those are numbers that have to improve. And even though there's going to be the embracing of the so-called IFRS, International Financial Reporting Standards, in 2011, a lot of improvement needs to happen here. Now, I think that's understood by Mr. Yun at the Financial Services Commission, and in his recent visit, he said a number of things that we can view as being positive, a move to more negative regulation than positive regulation, and a commitment by the government to enhance capital markets. Unfortunately, that kind of flies in the face of the current political debate in Korea and also the policies of some of the large companies. For example, the sudden fascination with poison pills, which are an absolute inhibitor of shareholder value and should be discouraged in all economies. I think should actually just be illegal in all organized market economies. Korea needs badly to have a more dynamic capital sector. And it needs a more dynamic capital sector by making liquidity of the market and greater, by removing inhibitions to corporate consolidations and investment of foreign capital. For it, right now in Korea, their best estimates are about $12 billion of private equity capital of various forms. That's the best number I've seen. Maybe some of you have seen other ones. So roughly about 50% more than was in the last Bain Capital Fund. One company, one private equity company, raised $8 billion in its most recent fund. For a company, for a country, the size of Korea with its economic dynamism, with its proven ability to invest large amounts of capital successfully, to have a stunted private equity sector is going to inhibit economic growth. And I understand that there are very real political, social, cultural concerns about the mentality of private equity companies. But when I put this in the context of external governance, it is because the private equity governance model has been demonstrated in the Western economies to be much more effective in terms of creating enduring value in companies than the public governance model. The boards are more focused on making the company competitive. The managers are more focused on improving the market positions of companies and enhancing their financial performance. That makes them more focused on asset productivity, which is a major issue in Korea, and also on building good market positions. So there has to be a recognition that without more dynamism in the forms of capital in Korea, Korea is not going to enjoy the type of competitive domestic market that it needs to continue to export its success and build companies that can build the types of global positions that are going to sustain Korean prosperity. And the same logic applies to venture capital. Despite the very exciting start to venture capital in the 2001 type time period, currently, once again, the best numbers available to me are there about $883 million of money committed to venture capital in Korea. One of the largest and most dynamic economies in the world, that is a very, very small number indeed. Similarly, and this has been very widely discussed, so I'm not going to dwell on it. It's clear that the domestic commercial banking sector in Korea continues to need significant infusion of talent, of capital, of technology, and of world-class disciplines. And I believe that foreign interest, both commercial bank interest, but also industrial interest and governments are going to be very, very interesting to see what is the final resolution of the HSBC bid for the Korean Exchange Bank, which today HSBC has said they're going to take their bid off the table, which I believe is not only bad news for Korean Exchange Bank, but also for other banks You know, HANA would be an example. Kuchman, that would probably benefit from having an international partner. Big global financial institutions are not going to be interested in having multi-billion dollar bids out for equity positions that sit around for 6 or 8 months with a 30% price premium, by the way, a very generous price by HSBC, despite the declining likely prospects of Korean domestic banks. So that, will there be some that will take pleasure in the fact that HSBC's bank will fail. The first people that will take pleasure in it, by the way, are Standard Chartered Bank. But while Koreans, many Koreans may think that's a good thing, I think it actually, in fact, has to be viewed as a reversal. And I think the proposed privatization of the Korean Development Bank is also going to be a very, very important issue that world financial markets are going to look to. Now, you may say, what does this have to do with the global growth of Korean companies, which my hypothesis is going to have to continue to be the principal engine for prosperity in Korea. And the reason is that there is no history of companies that simultaneously do not rely on a vibrant and world-class domestic banking sector and do not have very deep relationships with other countries' major banks being a success globally. Now, let me repeat that. With the absence of big Western banks with a significant position in Korea and a highly competitive number of Korean banks, and the absence of Korean banks' presence outside of Korea, the international branch banking network of Korea Exchange Bank, Shinhan, and Woori collectively is about 60 branches, roughly the number of branches that Citigroup has in Brazil. So the Korean growth companies going abroad do not have a Korean banking infrastructure on which to rely. But since the big global banks have a stunted presence in Korea, they don't have the type of sophisticated banking relationships they're going to need to fund their growth in more dynamic, more competitive global markets. So this is an absolute priority for Korea to get straightened out. The Korean economy cannot have a inefficient, technologically backwards, badly regulated domestic banking sector and succeed internationally, period. And this has been a topic of conversation among friends of Korea for 15 years, 20 years. So, you know, it's like the weather. Everyone talks about it. No one does anything about it. This has got to get solved. And that's why I'm so disappointed by the news from HSBC, even though I actually have many friends at the Standard Chartered Bank. This is not good news for Korea, even though there will be many who mistake it as such. I am not going to talk about Lone Star, since it's such a volatile topic, except to say that relative to some of the other changes I've already suggested, the need for more private equity presence in Korea, the need for foreign investors to feel confident in investing in Korea. Korea only gets about $12 billion of FDI a year, which is very small relative to the absolute size of the economy. So events like Lone Star inhibit the formation of more private equity in Korea, inhibit the flow of foreign direct investment into Korea, and confirm that the Korean banking sector is going to be treated differently than banking sectors in developed economy need to be treated. So put aside whether or not there were violations of law, put aside whether or not there were undue influences, just the mere fact of that makes Lone Star important on an ongoing basis. Well, let me turn more, if I may, to the internal world of companies, because this is something where I believe that the big Korean groups have to spend quite a lot of time and attention. And before I go through a list of areas in which the companies need to improve, and of course I'm in the improvement business. I try to help companies improve, so I tend to focus on what they could do better as opposed to what they already do well. Let me just say that if one were standing at this podium in 1980, 1990, or the year 2000, and started to articulate the challenges facing large Korean companies and how difficult they would have been, they were going to be to overcome. And particularly if one were to bet against Korean companies at those times, one would have been consistently wrong. So the number one attribute of big Korean companies so far is they've proven to be resilient and proven to be able to rise to many challenges. Over a period of time where they've received less and less protection, less and less subsidy in the forms of cheap credit, or currency value manipulations and things like that. But as they progress as competitive institutions, playing more and more by the rules of the big Western companies, let me just identify four areas that I mentioned earlier in the internal world that have to improve. And the first is internal governance. And what do I mean by that? Governance, doesn't that mean Securities Exchange Commission or NYSE? Well, internal governance, by what I mean by that is the way a company runs itself, how the decision rights are granted, who gets to make what decision, how people are incented to do that, how information flows, how does the company make decisions, both in terms of process and in terms of management rights. And the Korean governance model is of one I think all of us, I could stop now, go back to my life as being a professor. I wouldn't want to write on this screen, but get a flip chart up here and ask you to give me the attributes of the way big Korean companies are run, and I think we'd have a very shared list, rather centralized, rather hierarchical, very much oriented on operating measures of performance. Very interested in numerical data, not qualitative data. Very risk averse. None of those are the attributes of companies that will be highly successful in the global economy in the next 25 years. It will not be possible to refer all decisions back to headquarters. It will not be possible to turn all decisions into numerical exercises, and it will not be possible to have highly hierarchical decision-making where the imputed mindset for middle managers is that it's better to do 10 things in a year and get them all right than to do 100 things in a year and get 90 of them right. So there has to be change in the way Korean groups are managed internally. And that's going to require significant change in the second area I wanted to talk about, which is human assets. In my view, Korea lacks the human capital to fulfill its ambitions and its potential in the global economy. I mean that by in no way to be a reflection of a criticism of Korean management talent, which has proven itself in some of its great successful groups, or the capacity of Korea to continue to create more and more highly educated, highly motivated, and more global citizens. But as an export-oriented country, probably most analogous in terms of its likely future economic makeup to Holland, to the Netherlands, as a country which must prosper through global trade if it's going to be successful, the ability of Korea to create well-rounded executives with significant global experience and fungibility, movability across different environments, Korea cannot possibly keep up with that. So that means that Korean companies are going to have to begin to show some new skills in terms of accommodating non-Koreans in management. Now, let me just backtrack for a moment. We have to remember that the typical Korean company, particularly at high levels, is actually remarkably overeducated. Korean companies have the highest ratios of U.S.-educated PhDs in management of any companies in the world. You know, so in the United States, you want to be CEO, you go to Yale Law School, you go to Harvard Business School. You want to be a CEO, in Korea, you go get an engineering PhD at one of the distinguished universities of the West. And so tremendous human capital in these companies. but not enough of it. And painfully, today, a very low starting base in terms of foreign nationals in general management positions. Of the major economies, the major trading nations, Korea has the lowest ratio of non-nationals in senior management. Zero, bottom, last. Now, there's a little anomaly there because the Japanese have a big enough services sector, particularly in financial services, so that they get a little bit of a boost. If you equilibrated, you know, how does the Japanese manufacturing sector look versus the Korean manufacturing, it's more even. But having said that, Korea's last place, and that has to change. Why is it the case that that is? Well, first of all, Korean companies have not been particularly interested in or accommodating of foreigners. Some of that is a sense, I think, and I would defer to you and particularly members of the society. Frederick's got a great anthropological background. He could give us a non-business explanation for this, but it's everything from lack of comfort to lack of accessibility to lack of competitiveness in terms of compensation packages, significant centralization of all significant decision-making in headquarters, which is inevitably in Seoul, and Seoul has not been an attractive locale for global managers that are in demand by lots of different leading companies, particularly earlier in Korea's history when many of its leading companies were still aspiring to be leaders as opposed to being leaders. And, of course, there are other language and social barriers. Now, I think it's going to be very interesting to watch developments at LG Electronics. They've now taken on a very aggressive stance about hiring global managers and, of course, have announced the official adoption of English as their corporate language of business. I think we all have enough friends in Korea, and specifically maybe friends at LG Electronics, to understand that that will probably be the case in many management meetings, but will not be the case throughout the company for quite some time. But it's a good aspiration. And echo steps taken by leading German companies and French companies over the last 20 years as they have begun to realize that English has emerged as the definitive language of business, and there's no use in fighting that trend. You know, when the French make that concession, that it must be, in fact, inevitable. But as we look forward, I think Japanese companies have got to look to companies like some of the leading Dutch groups, Philips, TNT, like companies like Standard Chartered, like British Petroleum, actually, BP, which, although it's not enjoying a very high reputation these days, companies that have turned their capacity to attract foreign nationals of high talent into the company and retain them into a significant competitive advantage. Korean companies can't be cautious about this. I think they have to have the same type of ambitions that they've showed in having global manufacturing, production, and technological assets in the domain of human assets in the next 10 to 15 years if they're going to be successful. And the thing about Koreans, my friends in Korea, and certainly the companies I've worked closely with in Korea, is they actually have several attributes that many Westerners will find attractive. First of all, Koreans like to win. And so if we can, as a matter of fact, I've never met a Korean who's a good loser, not yet at least. So that everyone likes to be in a company that aspires to win. And everyone likes to work in a company where facts matter. And everyone likes to work with a company that thinks big. And this comes to the final thing I want to say in the human assets domain, which is companies that have been succeeding, and I think companies that will succeed in the battle for global talent going forward, are companies that have a very expressed moral purpose. They can explain to their employees why those employees should want to work for those companies, and they're not going to explain it in dollars and cents or won. Matter of fact, all the literature in terms of rewards and incentives in companies demonstrates that after a point in time, people get to a level of income. For an investment banker, it's, well, I can't jump that high, but for many people, it's, they get to a level of income that gives them a lifestyle they're comfortable with, after which they start asking, what else am I getting out of this? Why do I come to this place to work? And unless that answer is somehow fulfilling, people in with the types of skills the Korean companies are going to require going forward will, if they don't have an answer for that, they will leave. And it's the companies that have a good answer for that that will attract them or will retain those same people. And to me, the moral purpose of Korean companies over the last 25 to 30 years has been very clear, which is to build a more prosperous, stable Korea. Most Americans, as Frederick and I were saying, you know, would not really appreciate not only that Korea in 1955 was completely devastated, or that it's really only been a significant functioning democracy for 20 years. I think it's the 17th presidential election that they just had, but only the fifth one that was really an election, as most people would recognize it. So that the principal thrust of all Korean society was to make Korea a prosperous place where people had a decent standard of living, a very patriotic and noble ambition. But now, you know, Seoul is a vibrant international city. You have four of the global 100 headquartered there. That aspiration has got to change, and the obligations of the LGs and the Samsungs is as much now to their other stakeholders than it is the Korean populace. So Korean companies, I think, have got the ability to express that moral purpose in terms of winning, in terms of that being the defining technology players in their spaces, whether it's flat panel displays or memory chips or increasingly things like telecommunications handsets. Well, I can go on this particular theme, and I know all of you have got other obligations today, so let me talk about two last themes, innovation and globalization. In innovation, Korean companies, I think, have a profound challenge, and it's not for lack of brain power, but it may be for lack of imagination. We've done very extensive research on innovation models in our corporate practice, and we define there as being 10 different ways in which a significant innovation can take place in a product or a service. And I'm not going to go through all 10 for you. You can actually go onto our website and find that if you're interested. But there are two or three truths about innovation worldwide. The first is that most innovation dollars are spent on either product features. I have a product like this microphone. I'm going to try to improve it by improving its feature functionality, or in the associated system. And in fact, of the major economies we studied, Korean companies are the most likely to invest their innovation dollars in those two areas out of the 10. They don't invest in changing the customer experience. They don't invest in changing the financing of the product. They don't invest in changing the distribution of the product. Those are some of the other 10 areas. Unfortunately for Korean companies, the areas in which they invest are statistically correlated with the lowest returns on investment. The least important breakthroughs in terms of innovation come from direct product improvement. That's where the lowest returns come. Doesn't mean they all fail. But it means if you look at the returns to innovation in terms of market share, in terms of return on investment, they come disproportionately in other areas. So Korean companies, being very engineering-oriented, you know, run by engineers, tend to invest in areas which are very expensive and very low return on the whole, not always. So Korean companies are going to have to move beyond that model. It would be very helpful if some Korean managers actually met some of their customers, for example, particularly if their customers are Western consumers. I'm not talking about shipbuilders meeting Mr. Molarf, who's the 95-year-old patriarch of Maersk. But more orientation toward how distribution channels work, more orientation toward how customers actually react to products, more orientation to how products are financed, Notice if you have a weak banking sector, you're not going to have dynamism in that area. So Korean companies are going to have to both attract the human assets they can think innovatively and then refocus their ambitions, particularly since they rely so much on global trade. The world does not look like Seoul and Chicago and Paris. 65% of all the growth and demand for everything is going to be in places outside the OECD. And Korean companies are good at going into the countries and building bridges and dams and are good at exporting cell phones there, but they're not good at understanding those consumers, the differences in the distribution channels, difference in financing environments, and they're going to need to do that to be successful and to contribute to Korea's ongoing prosperity. By the way, I'd also add that Korea's lack of a very well-developed services sector, business services sector, is also a major problem here. Korea doesn't have successful market research firms on their own, doesn't have successful consulting firms, not many, doesn't have successful global investment banking firms. Not that all of those things are absolutely necessary, but the lack of indigenous resources to be supportive in those areas, I think also detracts from this type of thinking. Finally, and maybe most importantly, I want to talk about how Korean companies have historically thought about globalization and how they may want to do that. There are different models that companies use to globalize. You have companies like Toyota, which historically made all the Toyotas in Toyota City and put them on ships. Eventually, the city got too big, and the moronic policies of the United States government in the 1980s encouraged forced Japanese companies, to start building factories in the United States. I'll just take a quick digression. Why do I call those policies moronic? Well, first of all, they were perpetrated by morons, which is one of the operative definition of moronic. But it was stupid in multiple dimensions. It was stupid because putting in tariffs is generally dumb, especially if you're a big trading nation. It was also, of course, since we put in voluntary restraints on the number of vehicles imported, that, of course, encouraged Japanese companies to start making higher value-added vehicles and stopping making entry-level vehicles. So they started discouraging Japanese companies from making cars where U.S. companies couldn't compete and couldn't make money anyhow, toward making cars where the United States companies made all their money. So you end up with the Toyota Tundra, and Lexus. And you couldn't write about it in Harry Potter and have anyone believe you. So you have companies like Toyota that have those types of really export-led centralized models. Boy, that sounds like Korea to me. But you have other models like high levels of local control. One of the great global companies of the last 100 years is Nestle. And you can go to Nestle corporate headquarters in Vevey, near Geneva, which is a lovely spot. The corporate center there runs technology and does a lot of sourcing, but the local country manager is king in Nestle. If he or she decides not to sell this product or that product, that's up to them. They have to make their budget. No one tells them what to do. Very radically different model than Toyota's. Very different from I think in some ways the most durable and successful model, which I'll call a replication model, where you have a country with company that has a core strategy, but then in launching it domestically, keeping that core, innovates and changes around the fringe of that core strategy. So you can see that with companies like Vodafone, and you can see that actually in the big sector that the U.S. dominates, which are all the services companies. Yes, there are exceptions, the Publicis Group, for example, in France, but the U.S. dominates the advertising industry. It dominates the consulting industry. It dominates the investment banking industry. It dominates the public accounting industry until the further provisioning of regulatory interventions, which have helped undermine at least the globality of public accounting firms to a degree. We have distinguished representative of PwC here, but USA. So I won't get into my rant about things like Sarbanes-Oxley. We'd be here for dinner. But in any case, there are different models of globalization, and the current Korean model is highly centralized, highly command and control. Export the model we have here, including the upper management and the middle management. So if you look at, for example, something like LG Chemicals in China, they've been there 10, 12 years. They barely employ a Chinese off the shop floor. Surely no supervisors. How much commercial success are they having? Not as much as they should, because they're not really part of that community. And as Korean companies aspire first to get out of big capital industries like flat panels, where you have to have super high capacity utilization, and try to enter other areas, they're going to find that model fails. And you don't have to look a whole lot further than Zenith, do you? So LG bought Zenith, not probably a very astute acquisition. But even if Zenith had been in a durable position, which it was not at the time, LG didn't have the management resources to fix it, because it can't be fixed from Seoul. It had to be fixed in Chicago. It had to be fixed by people who knew the U.S. market, had to be fixed by people who understood the distribution, had to be fixed by people who had the right to make decisions. Remember what I was saying about internal governance, that were appropriate to that point in time without having to fly to Seoul every 3 weeks to explain themselves or explain every variance in the numbers. And the here may be the greatest risk to the success of Korean companies, because Korean companies are successful because they execute. They make a decision and they execute. Now, sometimes the danger of a company like that is if you make the first initial decision and you're a relentless execution machine, you'll dig a hole deeper than a bulldozer, right? You'll make a big hole fast. Just as the bulldozer is done. But the point is that type of execution model, they're going to have to redefine what execution means and make it much more local, innovating to meet local needs, innovating through getting new types of human assets involved, and move away from what in fact is a rather failed model, and what Korean doesn't like this, of the Japanese. The Japanese globalization model is mostly a failure. There are exceptions, like Toyota, but it's mostly a failure. You know, Nippon Steel, big success. Mitsubishi, you know, heavy industries and aerospace, big success. No. Japanese services companies, big success. None. You know, even Japanese banks, kind of serial failures, actually, internationally. Sony, big success globally. No, they're good at exporting PlayStation 3. Movie studios, big fiasco. So, you know, I've found regularly with Korean companies, if I say don't be too Japanese, they like that. And Korean companies need to move away from this centralized model of globalization if they're going to have success. Very interesting. I'll be very interested, as I'm sure all of you will be, to see how the Doosan Ingersoll Rand acquisition goes. I think it was an aggressive move. And I'm hoping I know no one at Doosan. They're not my customer. I'm hoping it's a big success, because I think we have to get beyond the AST failure and the Zenith failure, and cause Korean companies to be more self confident in making acquisition. So all of this to me says that, you know, Korean companies, which have to be the engine of Korea's continued prosperity, have many, many challenges going forward. They're going to have to improve governance. They're going to have to help drive improvements in external governance while adopting improvements in internal governance. They're going to have to think more generally, broadly, creatively about human assets, about innovation. And they're going to have to get to some next level of maturation in their global strategies. But having said that, and having been a friend of Korea and someone who's enjoyed good relations with some of Korea's leading companies over the last 20 years, I can say I wouldn't bet against them. But it's going to be, just as challenging as any set of challenges that the country has ever met, because it requires it to the type of growth and learning and no longer relying exclusively on things that have become a second nature and are a source of great accomplishment and competitive success by Korean companies. So I'm going to stop there. I hope those comments were of some interest to people. And do we have time for questions, Frederick?
So we're going to open the floor to questions. Thank you. Thank you for your talk. Two microphones will be circulating since everybody's time is precious.
Okay.
If you could not go too long with the questions and state your name and affiliation. Thank you very much.
What is the impact of the U.S. liquidity and subprime crisis on the Korean economy and their financial institutions, and also from an intellectual point of view on the sovereign funds, rather than, because there's a lot of resistance to them from various countries, what about instead of buying stocks and buying up companies, they set up 8 sovereign banks where they can lend and supply the capital, which is sorely needed because of the crisis here and elsewhere created by the extravagances and greed of Wall Street.
Well, I was at a major CEO conference in Europe earlier this week, and someone was asked a vaguely similar question. They say, "Well, gee, I wish I knew the answer, but if I did know the answer, I wouldn't tell anybody. I just go do something about it." I think the U.S. subprime crisis has affected every significant major economy. That was like a SARS on steroids, if you forgive me the metaphor. It the virus just spread like crazy, and everyone's got it. And you've got $1 trillion of value already destroyed and more coming. I'm much more worried about Korea's own impending subprime problem. 12% of mortgages in Korea are to low-income people, and there are more and more apartment flats that look that they're empty to me. So I think Korea's got an indigenous domestic housing problem in the making, playing into a weak banking sector. I'm not sure I totally follow your idea about banks, but I think the generally speaking, what Korea has been proven good at is managing production and manufacturing assets, not financial assets. So I think that the principal thrust of Korean foreign investment should continue to be along the lines that currently is. 42% of Korean investment outside of Korea is in manufacturing. 10% or 12% is in mining. Then you get to services, which is about 10%. And it's mostly things like SK Telecom. So I don't think that Korea is in a position yet to start exporting kind of invest in financing and banking know-how. In fact, they need more at home. Well, I mean, sovereign funds are originating from large pools of capital, either controlled by governments like the Bank of Korea, China rather, or by essentially family businesses known as the government of Saudi Arabia, the government of Kuwait, is a big family. I'm not sure that there really would be a model for Korea. It would be interesting to see if you could see some dynamism from some of the big groups in terms of thinking about partnering with some venture capital or private equity firms here to invest in more, once again, technical and financial assets. Because another thing, I don't think Korean companies are very good. Korean companies tend to be big and to hug things vigorously. So they tend to squash little things unintentionally. Mm. Yeah, I got it. Sorry, I misunderstood you. Sovereign funds investing in directly with Korean companies?
No, banks. Sovereign funds in sovereign fund banks to lend.
Well, I mean, I think it's a perfectly serviceable idea but they would have to. Most of the sovereign funds actually look for very proven models of investment because not losing the money is as important to them as anything else. You know, I had a Saudi, very prominent Saudi, who's made some investments that are surprising to me, tell me the other day that he didn't really care if he made any return on the investment for 25 years. He just cared that the principal was there 25 years from now. So his family had, you know, $1 billion somewhere in case they needed it. So they don't tend to, they won't tend to be as adventurous. Yeah.
Henry Segerman, International Investment Advisors. you seem to be saying that the big Korean companies should adopt free market principles, and that'll be a way of modernizing. But over the past 10 years, hasn't it really been true that the government has imposed change on the big companies? They forced Samsung out of motor cars. They forced LG out of semiconductors. The big groups are not even allowed to buy banks. Now they're trying to push them into holding companies. There are specific limits on affiliate investments
30%.
That they can make across the board in the big companies. Even in wireless, they had special price controls on what the SK Group could charge, which was lower than what the others could
charge.
I mean, it was just heavy
intervention.
Heavy intervention, which caused the big business groups to essentially reform themselves. We aren't seeing any move towards the sort of you're going to have to fall on your own sword,
right,
free market principles,
right,
in Korea. In fact, bankruptcy procedures in Korea are totally constipated, and they haven't reformed them at all.
Well, I think this is a there's quite a lot you said there, but let me see if I can be succinct in my answer. I think that Korea had a very conscious strategy for economic development that was a productive but extreme form of cooperation between the government and a very limited number of commercial elite. And it led to an extraordinary expansion of the quality of life for the average Korean citizens. Not all Korean citizens, but the average Korean citizen. And any one of us who's been to Korea with any regularity in the last 30 years, I think all of us are, after we should take out our old Kodak photographs, if you can find them, and look at them, because you wouldn't believe the differences. And for those of you who grew up in Korea, you saw differences in front of you. However, whether it's the way the Chinese are doing it now, the way the Koreans started doing it in the 1960s, the way the Singaporeans started doing it in the 1960s, these type of interwoven semi-corporatist relations are very, very hard to start undoing. And that is, I think, what we've begun to see happening, the kind of suppression of the tribal as these kind of feeding machines that just took over every sector consecutively. The imposition of more financial discipline and more capital markets discipline in a more limited way, not full blown. I think that it's important for Korean companies now to realize that they cannot allow to be competitive when it suits them and be protected when it suits them. I don't think it's possible even for Korean society to say that we really want to be world players on the stage, we want to be a big, important economy, we aspire to be number 7 economy in the world, but no one can come and compete in Korea, no one can take over a Korean company, nobody can do anything that is subject to, that could be perceived as too successful and therefore somehow bad, like Lone Star. So I think that they have another 10 years to go. And I'm hopeful that the big Korean companies will begin to understand that over a long period of time, the angels, if you will, are on the side of competitiveness, and the things they do to get temporary advantage and impede competitiveness ultimately hurt them in the long term. Hope that, and I agree, it's some of the process problems on everything from bankruptcy to continuing to allow sufficient levels of shareholder activisms and chronically underperforming companies, there's a lot of room for improvement, and it's got to happen because it's a tax on the economy. It's a tax on Korean citizens to have grossly inefficient services sector, for example, where there's no reform possible because it's inconvenient in the short term. Yes.
Can you go back to the Korean companies and tell them to pull themselves together and reinvent themselves? Because it seems to me that these American-educated PhD managers are opting for the old E-dynasty caste system where they're now the de facto yangban, ruler, scholar class. And it's very difficult to shed the old clannish mode because I understand that most of the Yangban class did not take part in the Japanese resistance movement, and they carried over and maintained their wealth and have tried to dominate the corporate Korean scene. So my question to you is, first, to shed the Yangban caste system mode, and second, can Korean lawyers work closely with these Korean companies? Is there like a sense of synergy, or is there a Chinese wall? I understand that typically admitted Korean bar probably makes up like 2% of the entire population. It's very different here. And so I'm thinking that that the distance, the gulf that they feel between the legal community and the business community probably attributes to the fact that they're still working on this merchant barter system to make profit.
Well, we had everything from the law to anthropology and some rather tendentious parts of Korean history woven in your question. Let me pick a couple of parts that I think I have maybe something modest to say. One is that I have not had much success in dealing with Korean companies that telling them that they needed to change because the way they were doing things wasn't right. I have had good success with Korean companies saying that if they changed, they could do better or they could win, particularly if it involved beating Japanese companies. So there's always easier to capture something with honey than with vinegar. And I do think that the most successful Korean companies have learned that, have learned that they do have to change and they have to have a more dynamic and more flexible management system and more open-mindedness than to succeed in the future, because they're competing on a different level playing field. It's different trying to win a spot to qualify in the World Cup than to win the World Cup. And, kind of interesting analogy, Dutch manager, right? Let's get to the quarterfinals. So I think it's going to be slow. And in some ways, big Korean companies suffer from the problem of success. In fact, big companies generally suffer from that. When a company gets successful, it is by definition really good at what it does. And that usually means a lot of focus, a lot of reinforcement processes in terms of the type of people you recruit, how you pay them, how you evaluate them, who gets promoted. And just as long as your success model is valid in perpetuity, you're safe. But no success model is valid in perpetuity, and therefore ultimately something goes bump in the night. So my in some ways, some degree, not harsh, but some degree of adversity periodically for all big companies, but particularly I think now for Korean companies, is welcome, because it causes them to start thinking about what they do have to do differently to get to the next stage of development. In terms of, I can't really say anything about the interaction of the legal industry and management in Korea. I just don't know anything about it to speak of. But I can say that I'm always in favor of a country that has a lower ratio of lawyers. Sir.
Hi, I'm James Lee. I'm with a boutique investment bank called Brock Capital Group. You mentioned that the Korean private equity sector and the venture capital sector are somewhat stunted. And I wasn't quite sure what you meant by that. Do you mean more that it is stunted as far as Korean private equity funds being able to grow and process deals in Korea, or are you saying that it is hard for the overseas private equity firms to come into Korea and to deal and to do deals? And if my next question is, if either of those is the case, what can be done? I mean, what can be done to encourage the growth of the Korean private equity sector?
My answer is both. The absolute amount of dollars in the private equity sector in Korea is low as a percentage of total economic activity, whether the private equity dollars are raised from Korean sources or Western sources. And certainly there's no activity that I'm aware of Korean private equity being investing outside of Korea. What can be done about that? Well, there's one thing that's very difficult to do, which is to try to remove cultural attitudes that are suspicious of companies, investors that are trying to make a quick buck and not dedicated to building up the business and sustaining the business. And heavens knows that relative to investing instruments like hedge funds, there is an interesting argument one can get about the long-term societal value of certain types of investment instruments. But unfortunately, as soon as you start trying to inhibit markets, you just start trying to draw lines, and you'll never know where to stop, because there'll always be, as we say, where you put up a fence, there's always somebody around the other side of it. So if you keep drawing lines in markets, you'll always have another argument why the line should be further and deeper into the market. What would have to be done about it? Well, first of all, one has to continue to remove anything that restrains the free flow of capital into equities. Poison pills, bad idea, because all it does is allow entrenched management to have another defense if they underperform, to postpone having the assets owned by new managers who will drive the productivity of those assets to the benefit of the owners. You have to have more robust reporting and accounting standards so people know what they're buying. You have to have more durability of and the word constipated on the bankruptcy process is exactly right. You have a more transparent and free-flowing judicial system, enforcement of contracts, whatnot, because equity flows to places that have clear and uniformly applied rules. And when the rules are subject to being interdicted periodically by whatever reason, whether it's politicians, and we could be talking about Germany, by the way, too, not just Korea, whether it's politicians or whether it's because the enforcement of financial reporting standards are slack or because there are mechanisms that impede the right of people to make investments that could be attractive because of securities laws that benefit the management of companies, you won't have a dynamic private equity sector. So what would you do? I don't know what you do. You can't do TV advertising to get Koreans to feel more comfortable with private equity. But I wouldn't recommend it, at least. But maybe we could have an exam on it and people could cram to study it. But having better, more transparent reporting, letting there be a free market in equities, having a much more robust banking sector that is a more astute lender to provide leverage for such transactions, encouraging more foreign capital to come in, and not having episodes like Lone Star and HSBC. Once again, putting aside the specifics of Lone Star that send a clear signal to Western sources of capital. You know, even though the president was here saying we want foreign direct investment, what the market has received as a signal is we want a certain form of foreign direct investment just as long as it isn't too successful. Well, that's an attractive investment hypothesis. I can't wait to sign up for that. So there a lot has to happen to free that up. I don't think that there, by the way, there's – that's not going to happen quickly. But the next if unfortunately, it would seem that this administration has already made it very hard for itself. I'm talking about the Korean administration to make some of the changes that would have accelerated that. But that's the type of change you need to make. How are we doing on time, Frederick? I don't want to hold people. Do we? Okay. Well, I'm not in a hurry. I just don't want to force people to stay who need to get going.
My feelings won't be hurt if anybody has to leave. Jim Altschul, Aviation Advisory Service. I'd like to follow up. I got a couple of questions relating to private equity. First of all, you cited a figure, and I'm both for private equity and venture capital. I'm assuming that relates to Korean-based or Korean-focused funds.
Yeah.
But there are also a number of well-known international private equity funds that on a regular basis raise billions of dollars right. for an Asia-focused fund. And
right.
To what extent are they, some of those funds, actively considering Korea? Second, I think you sort of touched on this, but if you have any other thoughts as to why the industry remains so stunted in Korea. And third, you're talking about how the banking system needs to be upgraded in a big way, but many of the leading Korean banks, after they got in trouble in 98, were taken over, or a number of them, by foreign equity. Why didn't the foreign, either equity or foreign investors, do more to upgrade those banks while they ran them?
On the first question of, let me take in reverse order because I'm more like to remember that way. On the latter, I think some improvements have been made. And you know, the banks are, as far as I know, more or less compliant with Basel II and are upgrading their technology, but they're still overstaffed. They're still late adopters of technology. They still have significant portfolios of loans that are at best, it's not as bad as in the past, but are best shaky. And things like Citi, did some good things in their investment. I think getting an HS Standard Chartered has. Getting HSBC would have put another bank on the path to being globally competitive. So there have been improvements in the banking sector. Don't get me wrong. It's not enough, in my view, to sustain, to create the type of backbone in financial services that's going to sustain the type of growth rate that Korea aspires to achieve. You're talking about 7%+ growth rate in an economy of this size. You need a pretty robust financial services sector to support that just for your domestic banking relationships and capital formation. So I think there's been progress. I think the Western influences in some of the banks has been productive, but it's inefficient. It takes an awful lot of work to do the right thing on some of these issues. In terms of are the Western private equity sources interested in investing in Korea? Easy answer, no. I mean, you've got guys, being arrested for doing a deal that the Korean government endorsed, and now on the Lone Star deal. So, and the allegations of criminality are technical in nature. It's not that they were embezzling money. It's they got the biggest complaint is they got it at too good a price. Well, they didn't set the price. Someone said yes. There's no major private equity source that I'm familiar with that has any interest whatsoever in talking about Korea, because they think that if they do a good deal, it'll be a gigantic hassle to get their returns out, and they don't particularly want to be under arrest in Korea. I admit that it's hard to imagine. Now, the truth of the matter is that there's a tremendous amount of private equity in the region that was formed to chase a type of deal that's now extinct, which is pre-IPO Chinese private equity. That's a class of investment that's going away because it's all been done. So as is, true of a lot of capital markets, latecomers, started raising either big funds or people that had early success raised big funds, and now one of the big outlets for that capital is trapped, is tapped out, rather. So if you had a more open and welcoming set of access to the Korean market, you might get some real influx. I don't think it's going to happen because it takes a while for capital sources not to get over some stereotyped characterization of a market. There's only one market that is historically, it's always been right. The same rule is always right, which is every 7-8 years, something goes wrong in Argentina. Other than that, it's markets are they do heal themselves, they do change, but right now, zero interest. And there's not going to be any interest, particularly, can you imagine going to your investment committee, a major private equity source in the United States now, and saying, I want to make a major investment in Korea? They've got shipping containers blocking the path of the Blue House. And they've got TV shows saying the Koreans are unusually susceptible to mad cow disease. No one's going to sign up for that type of, be the next person in the crosshairs. I wouldn't advise them to be. Frederick? You don't get to answer a question. You're the host.
Well, it probably won't be a very good question, so... I just was consulting with Young Cho here. I've been follow the Lone Star thing that closely, but I think there was some allegation that they got the good price they did because of some funny business relationships between those who were setting the price and somebody that was sort of working for them. But I don't, that...
A similar allegation that the, you know, U.S. Embassy was advocating, you know, for a low price, and what the embassy guys will tell you is they're saying the bank's going to collapse and you need an investor.
Right. But my question actually is attempt to look at something larger, and I don't know if you feel it's something that can be addressed, but what I was thinking listening to the presentation is, aren't Americans lucky because just doing the things that we consider virtuous and right for us will make us successful everywhere in the world, whereas Koreans and Japanese, who have a very different society and a very different set of interpersonal relations, have to, as it were, put off themselves and become somebody else in order to be successful in competitive in the world. And it seems to me to be, maybe that's what has to be. I don't know. Maybe that's what, you know, talking in terms of globalization really ultimately boils down to in the end. I mean, even France has, you know, sort of bitten that bullet in, since they got Sarkozy on the scene. But I think that's a really major challenge. So part of the reason why things don't go as smoothly as they should really has to be related back to the fact that this is a very, very difficult path that they have to follow. And nobody has, I don't think, a clear roadmap for how you go home with your wife and you act like a typical Korean guy, and then you go to the office and suddenly you're acting like a typical
Wall Street guy.
Yeah.
Three quick things. First of all, you know, when I was flipping through my notes before I stood up, I said, and remember, the first rule is don't start talking about Lone Star. So I violated that rule. Let me just make one thing clear. I didn't work for Lone Star. I had nothing to do with the deal. I don't even know the guys at Lone Star. But what I can say is that go 40 blocks that way, and there are a whole lot of people that didn't work on Lone Star, don't know anybody on Lone Star, and Lone Star has very much shaped their opinion about what's going on in Korea because they do read the newspaper. It doesn't matter if they had, you know, pictures of cash being exchanged between people, and that, you know, if it was all a lock cinch, you know, clear criminality on the Lone Star guy's part, that'd be different. But it's very cloudy. It's to my mind, it's more equivalent to what the Governor Spitzer, another thing. I've got economics, sex, politics. I've pretty much offended everybody here. Governor Spitzer did, you know, he went for what could have been technical violations and used the full weight of the government to try to extort something. And so I don't know what happened at Lone Star, but I do know it's got a very warping effect on the way the markets. I think your point about societies generally and this collision of what I'll call, you know, culture, national culture, and the culture of competitive marketplaces is one of the great phenomena of the 20th and 21st century. We know what type of society tends to, and what type of cultural attitudes do well in a market society. It's the cultures that invented it. You know, so we all ought to be Scottish or something. But, you know, you had a distinctive Korean society since the 8th century. In the 8th century, I don't think Edinburgh was probably inhabited by more than 400 people, and they were wearing before then they probably didn't have any kilts. In any case, in the 8th century, there were something like 25 literate people in Europe who could actually read, all monks. So I think and they were copycats. That's right. That's right. But you know, they thank God they were. So to make a long story short, I think that it is an incredible advantage for the Americans and for certain Western European cultures. When I talked about some of the issues here. One thing I probably didn't convey adequately is Korean companies need to think about what an effective, global, well-run company looks like for them. It's a mistake for them to say, well, what we should do is look like HSBC, or we should look like I don't know, pick your favorite company, you know, pick a good company or a bad company. But they have to come to their own path on this. But I do know that they're not going to do it with – they're not going to get where they want to go with the way they do things today. So whether it's, you know, finding ways to accommodate non-Koreans in management, whether it's finding new ways to put the incredible brain power available most big Korean companies to work differently so they are more innovative, if it's finding ways to make people from foreign nationalities in the developing world feel more integral part of the moral purpose of their organization. I was with a couple of African heads of state recently. They had a conference in Tokyo and they came through the States. And you know, with all due respect, the big Chinese companies, big Chinese interests in Africa are losing a lot of friends fast. And, you know, one thing the Koreans have for them is they're not really a side. You know, no one talks about the rivalry between Korea and the United States, you know, except we were in the same pool in the World Cup. Chinese and the Americans, the Russians, the Americans, the oil interests and the Americans, you know, the Americans and the Europeans, except when it's not. No one starts off with a really strong negative attitude about Koreans. You know, they have it about Japanese, God knows, in a lot of the former co-prosperity sphere. And they've got it in, they got it about Russians, about Americans, about former colonial powers. So maybe there's a path there. Well, I think one more.
I promise we can conclude.
Okay.
This question, that is.
No, I think I've everyone goes and you take an aspirin now because I've been talking to you a lot. Well, thank you very much for your coming, and thank you to the Korea Society for hosting me.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, or management.
Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Members of the Korea Society are notified of all Korea Society events, enjoy discounts on admission to programs, and a complimentary subscription to the Korea Society Journal. Membership may be purchased online at our website, www.koreasociety.org.